is Williams for L.A. Gets it over the line, dumped the high one in, wide of the net. Cougar comes back to help for Chicago, but it's loose to the line. Martinez looks at the net, score! L.A. Kings are going to the final. It's another strange-looking goal shot from the blue line. And the L.A. Kings have defeated the defending Stanley Cup champions, the Chicago Blackhawks. 5:47 of overtime. It's the Kings 5, the Blackhawks 4.
Sound of the Los Angeles Kings snuffing out the playoff hopes of the Blackhawks in Chicago on Sunday. Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals is tonight here in Los Angeles. The Kings host the New York Rangers, and we'll get to that in a minute. But first, Republican Neel Kashkari skated away with the GOP nomination for governor in yesterday's primary election. Democrat Ted Lieu and Republican Elon Carr will face off in November for Henry Waxman's congressional seat. And voters, well, we're all in the penalty box. Sorry, couldn't resist that one. Jessica Levinson joined us earlier this week for an election preview, and she's back now with the results. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, good to be with you. Good to be back.
Okay, let's get to that voter turnout. 18.3% of voters statewide showed up to the polls yesterday, and around only about 13% voted in LA County elections. I know low voter turnout was expected, but these numbers, I mean, dismal, right?
These numbers are really depressing. I mean, I have to say, I was listening to the intro talking about Tiananmen Square and how hard people have fought for democracy. And not to be too serious about this, but we have a real problem when we have less than 1 in 5 people on the state level showing up, about one, you know, a little over 1 in 10 people showing up. I understand that there were no, you know, quote unquote, exciting elections on the statewide level, at least with respect to governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general. There wasn't a Prop 8 to get people to the polls. But still, what we have when this happens is that for each person voting, they're essentially weighing in on who's going to represent, you know, 12 or 15 of their fellow constituents. And that's not how our system was designed.
No, and that puts a really fine point on it. Now, why so low? Because some commentators attribute low voter turnout to relative satisfaction with how things are going in California. I guess you'd call it the fat and happy theory. You know, why vote when you don't want anything to change? Although I'm thinking with a prison system and government plagued by corruption, it's a little hard for me to embrace this view.
I think there are a number of explanations. Some, as I talked about, there's no star power on the top of the ticket. There's no real questions, no horse races. But as you said, some people may feel satisfied. I think on the other hand, some people feel really dissatisfied. I think if you talk to a lot of people, and unfortunately I hear this sometimes from my students, they feel like politics is not really a game for them. It's a game for really wealthy people or people who are very connected, and people feel very disengaged from the process.
Well, and they have a lot to go on there. I mean, that, you can't discount that.
Absolutely not. You know, unfortunately, as certain people with a lot of money continue to be able to voice a very, you know, a very, very loud voice in elections, the one thing that we all have that's the same is our right to vote, and we're not exercising that. So,
well, okay, let's move on to some of the surprises from yesterday. And I mentioned corruption, the Secretary of State race, in which 287,000 people voted for Leland Yee. And this is the suspended state senator accused of running guns for the Chinese mafia. That means Yee came in third place. And what? That is my well-formulated question for you.
Well, I wrote an op-ed this morning called What the What as well, so we're on the same wavelength. So to those 287 people, 7,000 people, call me, because what? You know, I think certainly in some cases it was intentional. You know, it's much easier to run against an opponent where you can say, so which types of arms were you trying to illegally trade, Senator Yee? So I think there was some gaming of the top two to try and, for certain people, get their favorite candidate to run against Leland Yee. But I don't think that can account for all of the votes. I mean, coming in third in front of two other well-qualified candidates, Dan Schnur, who used to run the Fair Political Practices Commission, Derek Cressman, who used to be at California Common Cause, I think it's very troubling. To me, it indicates that people are getting a lot of information for the first time, at the ballot. They're just looking at the name.
They're looking at the name, or maybe it comes under the category of any press is good press. There is no bad press. You know, name recognition. It's shocking.
Well, certainly name recognition, but I hope that, you know, when it comes to Shrimp Boy and illegal arms trading and public corruption, that it's not that any press is good press. So we will have to see what happened in this case, but very disheartening and surprising from my perspective.
Well, on to the sheriff's race.
Speaking of corruption.
we're on a trend. We're trending here. Long Beach Police Chief Jim McDonnell will face former L.A. Undersheriff Paul Tanaka. Here's Tanaka at his post-election party last night.
If I'm the top cop in Los Angeles County, things will be a lot different because the orders I give will be clear, they'll be consistent, they'll be sensible, people will be held accountable.
Okay, now Tanaka is currently under investigation by the FBI for corruption, and yet still voters went for it?
Voters went for it, but Jim McDonnell almost won. So Jim McDonnell, the Long Beach police chief who is running as an outsider, he was part of the LAPD. He was part of the team to clean up the Rampart Division, as listeners may remember. He got like 49.1%.
So so close to 50.
Crossed that threshold so that the Board of Supervisors could just swear him in and he could start his job, but he didn't. Paul Tanaka does have name recognition. I think this will be a very stark contrast for voters. Do you want someone who's coming in as an outsider, as a reformer, who's going to say, I'm going to clean things up? Or do you want someone who really rose through the ranks and was Sheriff Lee Baca's second in command? I mean, for listeners, you know, it's important to know that there was a citizens' commission that put some of the blame of the problems in the jail system on Paul Tanaka's feet. And so this will be a really interesting race to watch. It's a very, very powerful position, huge sheriff's department, really one of the biggest departments in the country. And I think that whoever wins will be in that office for quite a while and will set the trend for law enforcement. You know, arguably nationwide, they have a very big bully pulpit.
Sure. We'll be talking a lot about that on this show. Now, we have to talk about the governor's race. The GOP establishment certainly is breathing a sigh of relief today. Moderate Neil Kashkari beat out Tea Party favorite Tim Donnelly for the Republican nomination for governor. Now, we've all established that these guys are basically fighting over who would lose to Jerry Brown in November. So why was the GOP worried, if they were worried, and what really is at stake for them?
I think they were worried. So what's at stake for the GOP? Well, before, three Democratic state senators faced serious legal problems. In the Senate, Democrats had a supermajority. Democrats had every statewide office, and Democrats were really controlling the state, and it looked like the California GOP was on the decline. And the last thing that the GOP wanted, I think the last thing the party establishment wanted, was Tim Donnelly, who seemed to have a serious case of, foot and mouth disease at times, running as the party standard bearer. And so, you know, you had people like Karl Rove saying he's besmirching the party's name. We don't want him out there representing the party. And if you look at the registration numbers in California, I think that the party establishment and, frankly, a lot of voters are more comfortable with someone who positions themselves more closely as a moderate like Neil Kashkari, who isn't talking about Sharia law. And I think, yes, we're talking about who's going to lose to Governor Brown, but hopefully we'll have an interesting airing of the issues. And, I'm not sure, this is Neil Kashkari of TARP fame, and I'm not sure that that's a great talking point for California voters, but we'll see.
Interesting, and also a reflection of what's going on nationwide with the party. Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me, and welcome.
And we want to hear from you all. Did you go out and vote yesterday, and why or why not? I almost broke the polls. I had a bright, shining red light on my on my machine and had everyone running. Anyway, you can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or join the conversation on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. And and now a race of another color, the Stanley Cup Finals. The LA Kings have won three playoff series to reach the National Hockey League Finals. All three series have gone the full seven games. It's just been a bonanza for hockey fans. And they won all those game sevens on the road, most recently in Chicago, beating the Stanley Cup champion Blackhawks. But for the finals, the Kings will have home ice advantage. Tonight's opener against the New York Rangers will take place here in L.A. at the Staples Center. Helene Elliott is here now. She's a sports columnist. She's there now. She's a sports columnist for the L.A. Times, and she covers the Kings. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, the Kings have played a lot of hockey to get this far. Three game sevens, as I said. All of them won on the road. That's never been done before. But hockey, it's such a tough and fast game. What's the fatigue factor going into these playoffs? Is that an issue?
Actually, most of the players say that they are more exhilarated than they are exhausted.
Oh, the adrenaline must be amazing for them.
Absolutely, yeah. They said that beating Chicago in the way that they did in the seventh game, in overtime of the seventh game, was just such an emotional boost because, you know, they had lost to Chicago the previous season in the Western Conference Finals, and they really wanted to get back at Chicago for that one. And I think that they were just so adrenalized and just so energized that they're hoping that some of that can carry over tonight.
Well, just briefly, for those of us who didn't watch, and I'm going to admit that was me too, will you take us through this three series the Kings have played? It's been such an amazing run, starting with this first round against the San Jose Sharks, when the Kings came back from being down 3-0. And right there, it seemed like it was maybe over.
Yeah, it was a pretty dire situation that they found themselves in that first round against San Jose. Comebacks from being down 3-0 are rare in any sport. It's only been done once in baseball, I believe, and it had only been done three times in hockey, and the Kings became only the fourth team to do that. And San Jose is a team that had a better record than the Kings did during the regular season too. So it was a very emotional series for the Kings. And then the Ducks, of course, their nearest geographic rival. That was a lot of back and forth, a lot of emotion, a lot of hard hitting, very physical series, very tense series. And the Kings pulled that out by winning in Anaheim and winning up by a big margin in Game 7, which doesn't always happen. And then Chicago, I mean, it was just great hockey for anybody who's a fan and people who maybe just are looking in on the game. That series was just spectacular. There were no fighting penalties. There were no major penalties. There was good, honest, hard-hitting hockey, and it was great stuff to watch.
Well, goalie Jonathan Quick was a big reason that the Kings won the Stanley Cup 2 years ago, but a lot of people have commented, including yourself, he hasn't looked quite as invincible this year. How important is he to the Kings going into these games?
Absolutely huge. Some of the questioning this morning actually was centering on the fact that in all the other playoff series, you could say Jonathan Quick was the best goalie on the ice, no question. And in this series, the Rangers goaltender, Henrik Lundqvist, has had better numbers in the playoffs so far. So you could argue that maybe he's the better goalie out there. And some people have actually said that maybe the Rangers have an edge in goaltending in this series. But I talked to Dustin Brown, and he was saying, you know what, maybe Jonathan Quick's numbers aren't as good as they were 2 years ago, but he's come up with the big save when we needed it. And that's the key thing. And I'm sure Quick is the first person to say it as well. You know, he doesn't care what his personal statistics are as long as the team wins.
How did the Kings get here? Coach Daryl Sutter took over the team halfway through the season 2 years ago when they won the Stanley Cup. How much of a difference do you think he's made to getting the Kings so far?
I think absolutely huge. You know, the previous coach, Terry Murray, installed a very good foundation. He really organized the team well in terms of teaching them how to play defensively. Even the forwards, everybody had to be responsible. You couldn't just, you know, skate up ice and kind of hang around there. The forwards have to play a two-way game, and that education was very good. It served this team very well. But Terry Murray, I think, could take the team only so far. And they brought in Daryl Sutter, who had been away from coaching for a little while. But I think one thing that Daryl did was reinstill confidence in a lot of players. He's very demanding, but he's very fair. He played a long time in the NHL, so players have a sense of respect for that. And Daryl has really done a nice job in terms of knowing whose buttons to push, you know, when to back off, when to kick somebody in the rear end, you know, made some lineup changes, particularly, you know, after they were down 3-0 to San Jose, he tinkered with the lines a little bit, you know, took one guy out of the lineup, put in another, a different guy. He had a very good touch in that regard, and players respect him enormously.
Now, what about the Rangers? What can we and what can the Kings expect from them this series? And they played twice in the regular season and split one.
Yeah, those games were so long ago. It's almost like a lifetime ago. One game was in October and one was in November. And at that point, the Rangers were struggling. They actually opened the season with, I think it was a 9-game road trip because Madison Square Garden was being renovated. So they didn't have a home game for a very long time. So they were wandering around North America. And they didn't have a very good start, and that's something they had to overcome later in the season. The Rangers are a very fast team. I think that's the one thing that everybody on the Kings has been saying, and I think that's one thing you can pick up from watching their games in the previous rounds. They've done a wonderful job defensively against their opponents. Sidney Crosby of the Pittsburgh Penguins was almost a non-factor in that series because the Rangers played such good defense.
Can't wait. Helene Elliott, sports columnist for the LA Times. And I don't even watch hockey. It has been great to talk with you. Thanks. You fired me up.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Coming up, new technology to both protect our privacy online and to invade our privacy in public places. A privacy technology arms race update. That's just ahead on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogay, filling in for Madeline Brand. Well, Apple held its annual developers conference this week. The world got a sneak peek at the next generation of operating systems and some kind of jazzy new apps, allegedly. But during the presentation, one new development almost flashed by without notice, and it could have a big impact on the way we all search the web in the future. To talk about that and other tech news, I'm joined now by two journalists with Slate's Future Tense blog. That's a collaboration between Slate, New America Foundation, and Arizona State University. Ariel Bogle is a researcher with Future Tense, and welcome, Ariel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Lily Hay Newman is a staff writer at Slate and contributes to the tech blog, and it's nice to have you with us as well, Lily.
Hi, great to be here.
Okay, well, I'd love for you, Lily, to start us off. Could you tell us about this new search engine option that Apple is offering, which is supposedly more private, and it has a cutesy name, DuckDuckGo?
Right. DuckDuckGo is a search engine that emphasizes privacy, and it's going to be in Apple's updated Safari browser in a new way. So
instead of going through Yahoo or any of my other search engine
options?
Or Google, obviously.
Our usual favorite. Google is the default, but now you're going to be able to change in Safari, both on mobile, you know, on your iPhone or on your desktop. So every time you use DuckDuckGo, it's not tracking you the way a lot of other search engines do. So it's not doing that personalization for your search results, which means that everyone's getting the same search results. That's a big emphasis of DuckDuckGo. And that's really valuable because it means that everyone's seeing the same thing and certain things aren't being artificially surfaced just because a service thinks you might want them. And also, by not tracking you, it means that you have more privacy in the types of things you're interested in and doing.
So this is like hitting a do not track button, right? Or being on the do not call list if you do go this way. And I'm assuming that this is Apple's counter to Google, which has been starting to creep a lot of people out.
Right. And so DuckDuckGo is a separate service, right? It's not owned by Apple. It's not an Apple service. But Apple's giving a nod to it here by making it a default option. And Safari is upping a lot of its privacy options in terms of private browsing and things like that.
Well, switching the conversation a little bit, one of the big venues or markets for new security and surveillance technology is major sports events, and we have the World Cup coming up in Brazil. Ariel, you've been writing about this. What high-tech security gadgets are going to be tracking fans there?
Brazil has just got so many high-tech gadgets for this upcoming World Cup. They've got US military bomb disposal robots, Israeli drones, British mobile scanners that can spot a 3D printed gun from a mile away, and a whole host of other things.
Wow. So is this a big step up from Sochi, which was also high tech?
Right. The funny thing is that it's not that much of a high step up. It's more of a slow escalation. Really, ever since the Athens Olympic Games in 2004, all these mega sporting events have just tried to match each other with the gadgets and the really overwhelming surveillance of players and spectators, and it just keeps going, and I'm sure will into the next Olympics, the next World Cup.
I'm trying to picture this. How high profile will those drones be? I mean, I picture people swatting them away like gnats.
Right. No, I wouldn't really expect that exactly. Most of the security will try and be sort of hidden. They don't want you to be scared. And
of course.
And right. Certainly sponsors of the games, all like Nike, Adidas and the rest, don't want their brands associated with any kind of military paraphernalia.
Okay, so this is all going on unseen, behind the scenes. Now, I know in Sochi, they use these biometric analyzers to scan the crowds for people who look suspicious, who had, I think it analyzed their muscle twitches, right, in their neck and head. Will they be using that too in Brazil?
It's unclear at this point. There's been some rumors that they might, but at the moment, they haven't said a statement either way.
Well, we've been talking about technology used off the field, but I understand there's going to be a new technology on the field to help referees, and it involves, it's this goal line technology. Ariel, can you tell us about that?
U.S. Football fans and fans of tennis, rugby, all those sports are really familiar with technology on the field, but this is the first World Cup ever where there'll be goal line sensors on the soccer field. So there's going to be 14 cameras around the pitch, and those cameras, if a ball crosses the line, will send pictures to a data room. They'll analyze that data and send a message back to the referee, who's going to be wearing a special watch that will say goal or not goal. And they're saying this will only take a second.
1 second to close that loop.
Exactly, yeah.
How are fans reacting to this, though? And as you said, soccer, it's such a low-tech sport, or it has been up until now. And I'm wondering whether we're going to have this situation like we have with Major League Baseball and replays, resistance to going the high-tech route.
Right. I think fans are really divided. The reason this all came about, people are saying, is because of a very controversial goal at the last World Cup. A British player kicked a goal. It hit the top of the goalpost and bounced down behind the line. That's what a lot of fans saw, but the refs didn't see it and called no goal. And people said that would have been a turning point in the game and advanced the English team. So fans from that side are very happy about this development. Then there are fans from the other side who are worried that this is going to divide the game. At the moment, a soccer played in a multi-million dollar stadium is the same game as is played on a street in Brazil. And so they're kind of worried about the lack of democracy or lack of fairness that introducing this tech into soccer will bring. People are also worried about the sort of stop-start that these technologies introduce to the game. I know that US football fans are probably very familiar with that break in the game when a ref has to make a controversial call or consult with the screens. So they're worried about that kind of ruining the flow of the game too.
Okay, moving on. I know another story that, Ariel, you've been following is the collapse of a program that would collect student data to help teachers track students' progress. It was called InBloom. So how was it supposed to work?
So InBloom was a student data nonprofit brought about by money from the Gates Foundation, Carnegie, and some others. And it was going to help school districts and schools collect data about their students to perform a variety of services, to keep track of grades, to keep track of bus schedules, to keep track of school lunches even. But over the past year or two, there were strong protests from parents who were really worried about the sensitivity of the data that was being collected about their children, and also the security of the data, of course, in the cloud. So InBloom announced it was closing down. It just couldn't counter the narrative that had grown up around it.
Well, Lily, did parents overreact? or privacy advocates, or were their reactions entirely appropriate and this was just, I guess, implementation of technology that wasn't thorough
enough?
I
agree that it's a tough call. You know, one of the problems within Bloom was that parents found out in one of the districts that it was collecting Social Security numbers, and I guess that was something that hadn't been clear before, or, you know, there was sort of some confusion about that, and that was upsetting that that really highly personal piece of information was associated with the students. And I think it's the problem that we're seeing in a lot of these big data tracking systems. You know, at WWDC, Apple's big conference that we were talking about before, Apple released two tracking software packages, HomeKit and HealthKit, that are supposed to track, you know, different parts of our personal lives for good reasons, right? There's you can see how having a lot of health data could help your, you know, from different doctors could help your health, or having all of your smart devices connected could make things easier in your home. But with any type of tracking like this, you have the problem of how to keep the data secure and how to have individual choice about what data is in that collection. And, you know, I think it's just unclear what's going to happen. It's unresolved how we can reconcile collecting data for good with the potential harms.
Lily Hay Newman and Ariel Bogle of Slate's Future Tense blog, thank you both so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, it's the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, and here in Los Angeles, one of the nation's oldest Asian American theaters is remembering the violent crackdown with a performance of an original work, It's All in Song. It's a musical in the vein of Les Misérables. We'll talk to their artistic director, Tim Dang, who wrote the book. And that's after the news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. 25 years ago today in Beijing, hundreds of pro-democracy demonstrators lay dead in the streets, and a few thousand defenseless student protesters in the heart of the city sang the Internationale before facing down the tanks of the Chinese army. Even today, it's hard to know how many died at Tiananmen Square because the Chinese government has suppressed any discussion and research into the events of those weeks in 1989. Here in downtown L.A., however, one rather unusual remembrance is underway this week. Beijing Spring is a musical about the bloody clash between student protesters and Chinese Communist Party hardliners. It's staged by East West Players, one of the country's oldest Asian American theater companies. Tim Dang is artistic director for East West Players, and he wrote the book for Beijing Spring. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why a musical about Tiananmen Square? I mean, what made you think I have to tell this story in song?
You know, this question has always come up to me. And one of the reasons why people sing in musicals is because the emotion is so high that mere words cannot express what they are saying. So they have to sing. My brothers and sisters. And this particular event of 1989, I felt was so passionate, had so much emotion to it, that why not a musical? And it was actually created during the time when Les Misérables, about the French Revolution, Miss Saigon, about the Vietnam War, was being made as all sung through musicals.
Well, that makes so much sense because the staging of it is also reminiscent of Les Mis in that you use large props and you use also video projections to place people there. But I noticed that you say in the playbill to this production that you followed the student protests in 1989 like the rest of us in the media here in the States. Well, what were your impressions then that you most wanted to capture in the musical?
You know, I think as an artist, what I was watching was the celebration of the human spirit. that these young students, and I would even say naive students, went into this movement asking or requesting or demanding freedom and democracy. And I don't think they knew what they were up against. They were up against the Chinese Communist Party. They were up against the hardliners who have been in control since 1921, and now it's 1989, and they're going up against this wall, so to speak.
A wall they couldn't even see.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. And I felt that this story needed to be told, that despite the outcome of the event, that this story needs to be told and told again. But unfortunately, like you said, that China has blocked this knowledge from its youth. And there are so many young people from China today who know very little about this incident.
Well, it's interesting that the story focuses on the experience of a young protest leader, Zhang, in Beijing. And it also focuses on his father and his grandfather, who both live in another city far from the capital and who both had their own experience of revolution. So three generations.
Right.
With
right.
all of the other things going on
right,
in the whole
right.
story of Tiananmen Square, you also have three generations. Why tell the story from this multi-generational point of view?
Well, the idea that we have, and it's probably more of a Western thought that we have as Americans, and in my case, and as an Asian American, that we feel that through time, that eventually, with dialogue, through challenging leadership, that change will come. And there have been all of these other movements that have happened in China, but unfortunately, they also have been squelched. And so I thought that in 1989, with myself watching it on TV, in front of the entire world, that how could the Chinese government of the People's Republic of China, the word people is in there, have the People's Liberation Army, again, the word people again, turn against the people. That there was no way that they would turn against the people, but they did.
With the eyes of the world on them.
Exactly.
And that's a theme in the show.
Right. Yeah. And now that they have this amnesia that this event never happened. And in fact, today I actually heard that anything from search engines, from Google, have already been blocked off because of the in advance of the anniversary that happens.
Well, as I was watching the show, I was wondering what a fourth generation, the son or daughter of one of these protesters, would make of the story that you tell, because the story has been repressed in China. Most of them only know the official version, and they don't have. In some ways, they have more freedoms now, but in other ways. They don't.
Right.
And they don't have the sense of hope that China's making history now. That's one of your recurring themes.
Yes, yes. We actually have two designers who are from China who worked on the play. One did not know anything about the event and was totally shocked about the event happening once she saw all the photos and the projections that we were showing, that this actually happened.
How old is she?
She just graduated from Long Beach. So I would say that she's in her mid-20s.
So shocked.
And she was our prop person. And then we had another designer, our costume designer, and she had no problem with it because her parents were actually part of the movement in another city. Not Beijing, but in another city. And so her parents were very supportive of her participating in this particular production.
So it depends what your... It's a generational difference.
Right.
It depends whose stories you're hearing.
Right, right, right. We actually had a group of LGBT interns attend the show several nights ago, and they were very distraught. And in fact, they were actually crying because they said after 25 years... We still can't talk about it. We can talk about it here in the States, but once they go back home, it's silence again. They were also touched with the son's relationship with the father and the father's relationship with his father, and that as LGBT interns, they could never talk to their father about their feelings at all, about who they are. And that also had touched them deeply in a way that we didn't know that the show could.
Oh, well, that's so moving and surprising
yes.
for you. And that is a very moving part of this production, that
right.
the older generation knows what's at risk and the younger ones don't see it. They're just
right.
pushing forward.
Right, right. And as the grandfather says in the play, we go on like we've had for centuries. Tomorrow, another day. So another opportunity to fight the fight.
I want to talk about the music. It's just... musicals can go either way, right? It's
right.
a risk. It's
yes.
always a risk.
Yes.
And you intercut scenes of students organizing the protests and making banners and very, very real and important but kind of mundane things,
right.
Hashing out their strategy with scenes of the – and you intercut them with these scenes of hardline party leadership deciding how to react to the protesters. And
right.
all of this is through – song. So on one hand, the music for the students is so Western. It reminded me of West Side Story, that
right.
the music and the dancing.
I think that that Joel Iwataki, who was the composer, that his musical style was informed by Andrew Lloyd Webber, by the creators of Les Miserables. So there was this pop rock feel, particularly for the youth. And for the hardliners, we wanted to do something that was more regimented or military.
Martial music. It
yes.
was martial, right?
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
and traditional, more traditional Chinese
yes.
themes.
And it had a communistic feel to it. And I think it worked really well in terms of bringing the two different generations together and how we could also clash as well.
Well, you wrote the lyrics.
Yes.
How do you write songs with words like democracy and neo-authoritarianism and ministry officials?
Well, with it was very challenging, but my, I guess, role model is probably Stephen Sondheim. Stephen Sondheim is the master of lyrics and wit. In fact, Stephen actually, Mr. Sondheim, actually wrote the lyrics to West Side Story. He wrote the lyrics to Sweeney Todd. His style has probably rubbed off on me. And so whether or not I succeeded at that, I was able to utilize words like democracy and government officials, the New China News, the People's Daily, you know, all incorporated within the music.
Well, you've been working on this show for almost as long as you've been at the East-West Players, right?
Right?
You started writing it in 1993, and it first premiered in 1999.
Right.
So how has much of it changed over the years, and have you updated it for this 25th anniversary run?
We have. It was originally a two-act play, and now it is a one-act play. We probably cut about 20 minutes from the show and put it all into one act now. And much like the students who were very naive at the time of the protests and some of them who look at it 25 years later, there is a lot more that we could have done in terms of strengthening the positions of the students and of the hardliners. And what we did as composer and lyricist was to bring a more realistic interpretation, to really show a balanced approach between the struggle that the hardliners were going through, because the hardliners were saying, we have a billion people to govern. The West has no idea how to govern a billion people.
Exactly. They have a big job there. And I found myself almost empathizing with those party officials.
Sure.
How to deal with this situation. And
sure.
they're so out of touch. And it could have been very easy for you to make them more buffoonish.
Right. And that's what we did the first time around. But after all this research, there was really hard thought that went into the hardliners in terms of the decision. The decision was very hard for them to make in terms of calling for that final,
brutality.
The final order.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So what do you want audiences to take away from this musical that they can't get from news accounts and reading the stories in the paper today of the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen?
I think that there was so much relevance to what happened back in 1989, particularly with what happened in the Ukraine, a couple of years ago in Syria, in Egypt, that there is this human spirit, and the human spirit really wants to fight for the greater good of humankind. I think that's the reason why I'm in the nonprofit arts business. You know, how do you tell the story in an artistic and educating way about the fight of the human spirit? And this is one of those perfect stories that really have the strength of the youth, of the next generation that's so concerned about what's going to happen to their future when they grow up. And I feel that our youth today, you know, really have that, our youth today really has that opportunity to make a difference in terms of what the world is going to look like for them in 20 years, in 40 years.
Tim Dang, artistic director of East West Players in downtown L.A., and his musical Beijing Spring runs through June 15th. Thank you so much for this. It was a delight to talk with you.
Thank you so much for bringing this up.
Star of musical theater is here. Light up
I
the
was
light.
In a musical once in high school. It's been a while.
That I'd love to hear. Yeah. Anyway, what's coming up?
I was
up?
The lead in Brigadoon.
Fabulous.
Yeah. But I'm not anymore. I'm going to be talking about Republicans on our program coming up, and the question of whether the establishment or the Tea Party really won yesterday. And believe it or not, there's some real questions about what happened. And in Mississippi, there's a dead tie. They're going to have a runoff, which is creating a problem for some of the establishment people, because it looks like the Tea Party guy is probably going to win. And in Iowa, it was very interesting, too, where the woman ran with, Joni Ernst, who ran a campaign commercial talking about how she was able to castrate a hog and how that would make her
able to cut the
budget in Washington.
I'm looking forward to all of that on To the Point. But first, coming up on Press Play, attempted murder, fraud, and rhubarb. One of these things is not like the other one. The true story of a CSA farm that went bankrupt and took members' money down with it. And that's just ahead on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Just what am I supposed to do with 10 pounds of kale? Or really, another honeydew? Now, anyone who's ever signed up for a CSA knows what I'm talking about. For the uninitiated, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. You pay a yearly subscription, and a farm sends you a box of fresh food every week or two. Well, this spring in Groton, Massachusetts, CSA members have a different complaint, though. They're asking, where the heck are my kale and honeydews? Megan Agnew is here to tell us about what happens when a CSA goes belly up. She covered the story for Modern Farmer. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so your story focuses on the case of a CSA in Massachusetts called John Crow Farm CSA. I'm curious, how much did members pay to join the CSA?
Well, there are several different levels. It was both a meat and a veggie CSA. So people would start at entry levels of, I believe, about $260 for maybe a 3 to 6 month winter veggie. And that went up to over $2,000, actually, for either chicken or beef and eggs along with veggies.
Wow, now that sounds really high to me. I've joined a CSA too, and you pay monthly, but $2,000 to put up front, is that about average for these kinds of things when you throw the meat in?
Sure, that was actually people paying up front for either 6 months or a year.
Okay, and is that average? That's what the going rate is?
It can be for a meat and veggie combo. It can go as high as that for 6 months or a year, yep.
Okay, and John Crow Farm sent out an email, apparently, this spring telling members that their CSA boxes would be a little late. What happened then?
And I can actually say I was a member as well, so this is how I first found out about it. It was a very innocuous email just saying the March delivery is going to be delayed a couple weeks. So hang tight, and you'll shortly hear from us, follow-up email. And then there was complete radio silence.
Nothing. No vegetables, no chicken, no...
Nothing.
Okay, that would get to me. So a little time went by, I understand. Members took to Facebook to complain. And I have some of the comments here from, this is from a page called What Happened to John Crow Farm? There are about 240 members of this group, by the way. So CSAs are based on mutual trust. That's why the betrayal hurts so much more. And this one, they took our money knowing the business was going down the tubes. I feel like I've been robbed. Strong feelings in the CSA community. Things get really personal, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, in general, it's a reflection of the positive relationship between members and farmers, and that it's very high touch and very personal.
Oh, right. You watch these, you play with these chicks.
Exactly. A lot of people have visited this farm. They've met the farmer's dogs. They've done pig roast there. So
yeah, it's like an episode from Portlandia.
Exactly. So when it goes bad, it feels very personal.
Yeah, but this is where things get weird and not so funny. What's up with the reports of a stabbing?
Yeah, so after a few weeks, one of the farm employees eventually came into the forum, and a lot of people knew of her, and she started speaking about one of the owners of the farm and that he had severely mismanaged it financially and was just very difficult to work with, and there was this accusation that he had, in fact, stabbed a former employee. And that he had pleaded it out, so it's not part of the formal record, but she used that as obviously a very easy way to underscore just how difficult he had been to work with. And it seems rather unprecedented, I would say, in terms of CSA stories.
No, but salacious. I mean, we had
exactly.
to throw it in there. So, and did this play into just the general mismanagement of this farm?
I think so. You know, it was a very small operation. There were two people who served sort of at the front, who served as the front people for the farm and actually worked with the customers. And then it just seems as if there were backroom dealings having to do with the finances and the leasing of the land that really played into the financial difficulties that they eventually encountered.
Well, okay, what happens if your CSA goes bankrupt then? What happened to all of you? Can you get your money back?
Sure. The short answer is no, at least not through bankruptcy proceedings. And this is what you discover is that so often when you sign up for these programs, the legal relationship is not spelled out in writing. So you might make your payment on PayPal or you email the farmer and very informally you become signed up. But when you encounter a situation like this, suddenly you realize I actually have no legal recourse.
Well, look, did you read your CSA contract? And I signed up. I didn't read anything.
Oh.
I think I called somebody up and that was it.
Oh, absolutely. God, no. I just, you know, this is all good.
Right. It's such a good cause. We're saving the environment, saving the world.
No one's going to pull a fast one.
Right. How common is it for a CSA to go out of business like this?
Well, it actually seems very uncommon, although it's difficult to track it unless you're actually looking for this info on a court or state-by-state basis. But as I mentioned in the article in Modern Farmer, there actually was a precedent out in Colorado, Grant Family Farms. And that was an interesting example as well in that it was a very large farm that had more than 5,000 CSA members, and it went through a bankruptcy. And they, similar to John Crow, were very non-communicative with their members, and that created a lot of bad blood.
Well, what do we take away from this story and the story of John Crow Farm? Is it a cautionary tale? You know, read the fine print?
You know, it is, but actually, in a lot of ways, I think people can be heartened by the story because what you see is a lot of passion on both sides, and the key to me is that farmers just need to be communicating with their customers because there is a trust factor and a trust issue here. So as long as farmers are being open with their customers, I think the mutual collaboration is there and can continue.
Megan Agnew is a contributing writer for Modern Farmer. It was a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Emily Myers, you're here with the Mail, also a person I trust implicitly. Don't read the fine print.
No one was stabbed in the making of the show today.
Not
welcome,
that I know of.
Barbara.
Thank
so
you.
Great to have you in the studio with us today.
It's so great
and
to be
for
here.
The next couple weeks. So to kick off our feedback segment today, we kicked off the show talking about elections and the fact that voters didn't really show up to the polls this year or for this primary election. And we asked listeners if they voted and why. We got a lot of people commenting on the KCRW Facebook page, which leads me to believe that if we voted via Facebook, perhaps the turnout would have been a little
that
bit better.
That is a very fertile idea.
It, you know, we'll see. The future is now.
Patent it.
Okay. Melanie did her civic duty yesterday. She says that California has such a robust system of voter ballot initiatives and the top two or jungle primary system were much more democratic than the average state. And that's why she's so disappointed that there was a low voter turnout.
I feel her pain. Yes. Okay. But
Melanie
maybe if you
Barbara.
Got a cat video back at you, it went after you
yeah,
voted.
Exactly.
That would help.
You're the reward.
I'm enthralled with your idea.
A listener called in with an explanation for one of our election mysteries that we talked about.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I was just calling to say why Leland Yee got so many votes. When I was voting yesterday, I was so shocked seeing his name there that I almost voted for him out of sheer entertainment value. So maybe that's part of what's to blame for him coming to third.
Wow.
So that's a voter with a sense of humor, apparently.
Instinct hit.
Yeah. Maybe he went against his instincts here. Mm-hmm. Andres Cunningham posted a quote from Mark Twain in response to our Facebook question, another voter with a sense of humor. He says, if voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it. So cynical.
Oh, wow. Burns. Okay. Well, thank you so much for that.
Of course.
And that's it for the show today. If you have thoughts, however, we'd love to hear them. And you can reach us old school at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or we're on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand. See you tomorrow.